we're going to talk about the state this evening, and very briefly why we're going to talk about the state. Well, like we observed that the politics at the Camp for Climate Action, which is kind of a temperature check of the sort of politics of the radical left movement, but also with lots of others, environmentalists getting involved, and supposedly a growing movement. We observed this sort of the different kind of approaches to climate change campaigning, and that not wanting to create a divide at all, but actually sort of perceiving sort of some discomfort from some people about the amount of workshops and kind of approaches at the climate camp of environmentalists who want to talk about carbon budgets and 90% cuts and things like this, but measures that involve the state imposing lifestyle changes on the citizens of this country. So other people have approaches whereby they don't want to engage with the state and want to build solutions from grassroots level. So so the point of having a discussion about the state isn't to kind of like to draw that divide and try and push the make a divide within the sort of the environmental movement, but to just talk about a little bit about the politics and I don't know, maybe later on with the second and third debates, work out where people's motivations might be in with what they want to do in terms of campaigning on climate change or other things in the future. But unless there's anything that you want to add to that, Eva, then I'll just crack on with just reading an extract from this report, which is called "The Future Starts Here: The Route to a Low-Carbon Economy." And so, as I was saying, it was produced by the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, who have been pretty influential in kind of arming environmentalists with lots of science and facts and figures in the last 5 years on the need to reduce carbon emissions. This report was published exactly 2 years ago. Basically, that report concluded that the government must act now to reduce emissions and produce a comprehensive plan to substantially reduce emissions, and to do it within the next 4 years, and to within the next 4 years introduce a comprehensive action plan to substantially reduce energy consumption and drive technological innovation. So I mean, we can see also in the 2 years since that report's been published, we've seen the climate change bill, which I'm not sure where we're at with that, but that was that's legislation that's proposing to cut carbon emissions significantly, not enough, like most people would say. But but this research is directly focusing on lobbying government to tackle climate change, and so I'd like us to discuss in a minute what people think about that compared to other approaches to tackling climate and energy issues. I'm going to just read an extract from the report. The report produced a route map for lobbying and policy framework and driving technological solutions to make a transition to clean energy and a low carbon economy. The visions within the route map are under three headings, which are policy framework, technology, and daily life. And with this pathways to a low carbon economy, this route map, it predicts that by 2030, the government will continue to track emissions and deliver year-on-year cuts in line with the climate change bill introduced, well, about now. Financial incentives needed are needed less often as innovation increasingly drives changes. The public encourage innovation through purchasing. Technology in 2030. Energy consumption is reduced almost a third from 2004. Carbon dioxide emissions down 70% from 2004, and fossil fuel use down by 30%. And renewable power accounting for 13% of all energy. hydrogen is beginning to be used, especially in industry. Fossil fuels, still a major energy source, but carbon dioxide from almost half fossil fuel use is now being captured and stored. CO2 emissions from aviation, surface transport, industry, services and households have fallen. Daily life in 2030, according to this influential route map produced by the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, daily life in 2030. Energy consumption in homes is reduced by a quarter from 2010, and people continue to travel just as much as they did in 2004, but there'll be more people per train, per bus and per aeroplane. Biofuels are being used for a proportion of fuel needs, and around 10% fewer cars are on the road. City centres are car-free, more people are walking, cycling or using more efficient public transport. Planes are flying slower to improve efficiency. Domestic and some European flights have declined. Larger high-speed trains have more efficient engines. That's one illustration of how life might be in 2030. So I suppose we could go on and discuss that a little bit. Someone else might want to pose some questions as a result of that. But for example, are these predictions realistic? Do they fill people with hope and optimism? Is it possible? And will it create a just and fair planet?
Anyone on that? I guess when we read this this morning, I guess one of the things that we were interested in about is that sounds pretty good. In 2030, we can still live like we're living now. So why not? Why not? Let's start working with the government and living like that, I guess would be my question. When these things are put forward, they seem quite attractive. So why do we make the decision not to do that?
Is it realistic? Are these predictions realistic? Is maybe a place to start.
I wouldn't so much say are they realistic, but one of the things which struck me there was that it was mostly the technical aspects of change. It wasn't looking at so much the social impacts, these high-speed trains and these renewable energy resources, who's got access to them? Inequality, social inequality, economic inequality has been deepening for the last 20 years, and it looks set to deepen. So I think we could have a sustainable society which would still be absolutely awful to live in. And so I think that's an aspect which is clearly being ignored when climate change is posed as a technical problem rather than something to do with the kind of economic systems. Closer. Okay. That's all I've got to say anyway.
Yeah, I just agree with what you said, but I think there's another distinction that I think is really important, which is the difference between a reformist agenda, which is what the government's talking about, and then making a very sort of clear sort of means-ends distinction, what are we looking at? I'm not quite sure how I want to put this, but I suppose a lot of what I believe in is coming from the radical left is sort of doing things here and now rather than seeing it as some kind of future goal that the government's going to impose upon us, which ties in with what you said about who is it for, who's going to have access to these. If the people who are putting these in place are a very sort of hierarchical representative government, then are these hierarchies going to stay in place? And whereas if we want power for ourselves as just people, if we want to bring it back down to the sort of small scale little person or whatever, then can we do that through a system that's representative and hierarchical? I suppose that's an important sort of the difference between reform and doing something here and now, and the ties that that has to relations of power. It's an important thing to think about, I think.
Do you think it's possible to do both, sort of lobby for reform that might enable us to mitigate climate chaos whilst building alternatives? Or
I'm not sure. That's something that I'm still thinking about.
On the issue of can we do these things at the same time? So doing the reform and also the more grassroots level thing at the same time. I think we should be careful not to dismiss these kinds of reforms, because if they can, do we have a clear goal of cutting carbon emissions by a certain amount to stop irreversible climate change? And that's anything which can help towards that goal is something I think morally we should support. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the opportunity which acting against climate change has to raise issues of grassroots organizing, anti-capitalism, to raise all these problems which are kind of central to the, but we still have to keep in mind that one of the key kind of goals is cutting emissions, and maybe that we have to look at reform as one of a as a kind of key aspect of doing that.
In theory, there's a, I suppose the government might follow the will of the people, and if people are seen to be wanting to be getting involved with new and different technologies and changes in lifestyle, and that the these predictions as like first drafts, we might think that the government as a populist wanting to hold on to people's votes and things might want to increase these as years go by and say, yeah, each year we want to, you know, so hope maybe their point of view might with time increase, and they might say, okay, these percents that we first suggested aren't enough, we want to do more for this, we want to get 50-60% of our energy from renewables, we might want to more highly tax, more high consuming, energy consuming services and things, offer benefits. That's perhaps one take on, you know, the state as a constant evolving.
Who are these reformist ideas working for is a question that I often find myself asking. Like, if we just say to the government, just reduce our carbon emissions to save everybody, who are they actually going to save? Because what is the world that we're living in actually going to be like if we ask the government to put in place these reforms? I guess that's what I wonder.
Right, I'm going to say a lot of probably unrelated things and try and make them sound related. So no, I just made it. Right, so I was thinking, I'm going to pretend it's a response to the last thing Eva said to start off. This is just etiquette. But yeah, so you're saying, you were saying like who would these changes be for, reforms? And I'd say, yeah, so the idea is if the changes came through the state. So it's trying to maybe look at historical precedent of when a group of people who were excluded from the state process tried to engage with it to actually force through their own changes. And I'd think like maybe the biggest like historical precedent for that is the Labour movement within like sort of the British parliamentary system, who engaged with the state, and all the structures of the state prior to the Labour movement's engagement with it would have been organised in a fashion to exclude their interests, because the existing parliamentary system was designed to represent the interests of all the like the landowners that had previously been part of it. So I don't know a great deal about that, what happened in like the history of the Labour movement, but it's quite evident that it's like dramatic changes occurred and stuff like that. So that's like on like one side. And then to completely contradict myself, when people bring up the issues of like state solutions and capitalism and reform of capitalism within in relation to climate change, like for me it seems really clear that capitalism is going to kill me before climate change does. Like capitalism is making serious inroads into my life already, as and state is, and the climate change is only going to kill me and every other living being in about 20 years, maybe 20 months, maybe 2 weeks, but like capitalism's well ahead. So that's just to like look at like the extremities of it on like on both sides of it. So this is totally unrelated, but like yeah, I just wanted to mention Monbiot because I think he's quite interesting, because he's in quite interesting parts. Sorry about the complete unrelatedness of everything, but like Monbiot is an environmentalist. and he's pro-state. And then, like, really scarily, he's pro-super-state. Like, he's pro, like, a global central state, which just, like, really confuses world the issue. Government. A world government. And I wondered whether, if we implemented a load of environmental legislation, whether the state would, as a result, dismantle itself, because an environmental state is self-contradictory in my mind. So maybe we should argue for these things and it will just dismantle itself through its own inherent contradiction. But that, yeah.
By the way, if people do want to talk at any point, you can just put your hand up. Like, if the other person's talking and you want to start a discourse with the person who's talking, that's not a problem at all. Like, you don't have to wait till you don't necessarily have to wait till the end of somebody's finishing.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with what you said on the contradiction between state and environment in protecting for the environment. For instance, Monsanto is a large company that we all know produces genetically modified food. And they are also working as boards on the FDA, which produces all of the standards for foods in the United States. So leaving environmental health up to the people who are on the boards of both genetic modification companies and also food standard companies, I think is blatantly harming the public, as well as leaving climate change or whatever other environmental issue there is up to the government, because I think the government is inextricably linked with corporation, and that's why capitalism is not going to help the situation.
Hi. Yeah, I'm going to come in on a slight tangent about technology and power and politics, because most of what we heard about at the beginning was about technological solutions to climate change. And there's a lot of issues around technology. Technology isn't just a neutral thing that you can fit into any political system. There's different technologies have different political implications and implications for power structures. And this is something we need to be very aware of, because most technologies are developed by existing power structures. In our system at the moment, that usually means state-run universities and primarily corporations, capitalist corporations. So you have to look very carefully at what technologies those bodies are developing and what the effects of those technologies are. So one example would be ownership. We've just had the example of genetically modified foods, and intellectual property over genetically modified foods is a huge issue. And it's one of the things that makes corporations so interested in that particular technology, because they can make a lot more money out of it by owning patents on foods, whereas they can't own patents on seeds for non-genetically modified products in the same way. So that kind of thing is an issue. So we can look at, for instance, the politics and the power issues around nuclear electricity, nuclear power generation. So, for example, nuclear power generation requires extremely high centralization. You don't build little local nuclear power stations. They've got to be big and quite a long way from where people live, preferably. They need a lot of security. They need a very high level of hierarchical, highly skilled organization. They need hundreds of people to run them. And most of those people need to be very highly trained. And all of these things become power structures. So if you're trying to change society so that people are living a more localized life and a more autonomous life and a less hierarchical life, then the technology of nuclear power stations isn't going to fit into that social model. So when we're talking about technological solutions, we have to look at what they mean for society and not just say, well, theoretically, possibly, for a while, nuclear power could reduce our carbon emissions, therefore it must be a good thing, because reducing our carbon emissions trumps everything else. No, it doesn't. I mean, I haven't even gone into any of the other issues around nuclear power there, you note. that's just on a pure if nuclear power was equal level.
Join in slightly and say that in some ways perhaps technology has been seen to not offer solutions. It's technology's got very good at producing huge amounts of food or huge amounts of power or these kind of things, and it's dealing with it. You know, we can, you know, we've genetically modified, or we've just mass monocrops and these kind of things, you know, providing enough food for everyone on Earth, but it doesn't mean that everyone on Earth is getting food. It means huge amounts of food in the West are getting thrown away, or it means huge amounts of energy are being consumed in the West. Lights, you know, we have so much power, we have so much technology that it's that, like, grasping to go backwards with it almost, that, you know, technology isn't helping. Like, it's a step away from technology perhaps might help.
Yes. That's very, very much part of it. It's also about ownership and control. So who owns the nuclear power stations? They're not going to be communally owned. Nuclear power is obviously an extreme example, but you can come up with very similar things. Sometimes technologies do have odd effects that the creators didn't foresee. So the internet being the obvious example, which has enabled, for example, independent radio like we're hearing tonight.
Can I just, sorry, make a small point before you go too far ahead, which is, it might seem like nitpicking, but I just wanted to pick up one of the things that you called, you're talking about technology as being run by, and I'm just, it's just a really small point, it might seem nitpicking, but I think it's quite important, is that you said that technology is run by corporations and hierarchy, which is fair enough, but universities, I wouldn't put them in a sort of essentially state-run category. I think that's a bit problematic, because they're actually private universities. I wouldn't say that they were state-run at all. I mean, that's a really complex...
They're state-funded in this country.
Well, they are. I'm agreeing. I'm saying, yeah, it's a very complex relationship. I mean, they have certain legalistic rules. They don't fit easily into either private or state, and they obviously have a lot of the relationships which we'd say were... They have a lot of aspects which are neoliberal and corporate, and I teach at university, and it's very difficult because I'm sort of, it's constantly hammered into me that you have to just make them pass their exams, and you can really feel that neoliberal drive towards just, I mean, that a lot of the funding comes from research bodies who are corporate or private, and a lot of the money comes from the students who pay fees who are from other countries, so the sort of whole globalization agenda and bringing money into this country plays into it. I mean, I don't think they get very much off government at all these days, and they don't get, I mean, the government sets the RAE targets and things like that, the research assessment agendas, but it's not as easy as saying that they're neoliberal or state, because there's obviously always been a sort of radical undercurrent within universities as
Without going too far away, can we just say that universities are part of the existing structure and power system?
I disagree completely. Because
can I interrupt and just say maybe that's good. We will have a break in about half an hour, and you could carry that on if that's all right. Just because we could go for
long enough anyway.
Okay. I was going to say, maybe we carry this on for another 5 minutes, and then we've got somebody else who's going to introduce... we've got Will here, who's kindly spent today researching for us to give us a little bit of information, for those of us who don't know, about green capitalism. And he's asked me to stress that it isn't that he's not an expert. He's literally just spent today on the internet and looked up. That's something he's known nothing. So he can bring us some information. So I'm going to bring him in, give about 5 minutes, and then bring him in to add another layer, as it were.
Can I just raise a question, because we've been using the word "we must do this" and we're all in the shit, or we're all going to suffer from a climate catastrophe, and I just question about what we mean by "we." I mean, I think most of us in this room know that most of the world are living in poverty. Most of the world actually need to consume more. They need to consume more energy because they're cold. They need to eat more because they're hungry, and there's a question of, who is this "we" that is, consuming too much, is using too much energy, is eating too much, is has the ability to buy and have made for them all these products that use energy. So it's just raising the question, who is this "we"? And I think there's a great, percentage of the population of the world that really are not responsible for what is, for this climate change. So, I think we need to identify who is, and obviously they, I think we've talked about some of the structures which keep that, what I would call a, you know, ruling class or ruling elite in power, you know, the rich or the that is able to, you know, to you know, have consumption which is way above what most of the world's able to have, and you know, whether, you know, that's at the root cause of climate change. And so, you know, before we start looking at solutions, whether technical or social, do you know why have we come, why are we in this state in the first place?
I think that's a really good point that we do need to cover today, is global injustice as well.
Okay, so yeah, as already been mentioned, this talk is by, it's not a sort of comprehensive overview of green capitalism, and just focuses primarily on two different and recent incarnations of green capitalism, or solutions to environmental catastrophe that still operate within a capitalist paradigm, and the first of which is free market environmentalism, and a French organisation named Research and Degrowth, which is in French, what? Okay. He recently held the Economic Degrowth for Ecological Sustainability and Social Equity Conference, and that was in Paris on the 18th and 19th of April this year. So free market environmentalism, I mean, what is it, you might ask? The definition provided by Wikipedia states that free market environmentalism is a position that argues that the free market property rights and tort law provide the best tools to preserve the health and sustainability of the environment. And rather than perceiving environmental problems as stemming from market failures, free market environmentalists view the emergence of environmental problems as the result of laws governing property rights that fail adequately to protect or define those rights, and laws governing class or individual tort claims that provide polluters with immunity from tort claims or interfere with those claims in such a way that make it difficult to legally sustain them. Free market environmentalism should not, of course, be confused with the stance held by ecological economists such as Robin Hanel, who regards the current environmental situation as a result of market failings in the following terms: over-exploitation of common property resources, over-pollution, too little pollution cleanup, and over-consumption. But the retort free market environmentalists would argue is that over-exploitation reduces intrinsic and retail value of the property, the effect of which is most clearly felt by the individual owners through limited co-ownership. Another claim, which is, I don't really understand, but pollution cleanup occurs naturally in a free market because reducing the negative value of property is a net gain, again leading to a higher intrinsic or retail value and thus marketability. And also, overconsumption is a flawed concept because it assumes that resources are non-renewable, also arguing that if a resource becomes scarce in supply, its value will rise and its consumption will reduce. They do, however, seem to concede that legislative and judicial authorities in general favour heavy industries over individual or class action. So there might be some sort of objections, but I don't really want to go into that now, and that will hopefully be the sort of body of the debate. So now moving on to the body named Research and Degrowth, organised the Economic and Degrowth for Ecological Sustainability and Social Equity Conference, inviting, according to the website, more than 100 international scientists and members of civil society from social, environmental and economic backgrounds. The result was a sort of manifesto, what they actually call a declaration, which outlines a sort of diagnosis of contemporary global environmental economic issues. And it consists of 8 points, and they seem difficult to contest. The first of which was economic growth, as indicated by increasing real GDP or GMP, represents an increase in production, consumption and investment in the pursuit of economic surplus, inevitably leading to increased use of materials, energy and land. And two, despite improvements in the ecological efficiency of production and the consumption of goods and services, global economic growth has resulted in increased extraction of natural resources and increased waste and emissions. I mean, it sort of go on that sort of tenor, but the sort of final one, and it sort of really sort of crystallizes some of the things we've been talking about already, is that if we do not respond to the situation by bringing global economic activity into line with the capacity of our ecosystems and redistributing wealth and income globally so that they meet our societal needs, the result will be a process of involuntary and uncontrolled economic decline or collapse with potentially serious social impacts, especially for the most disadvantaged. And so then we have a fairly sort of sound analysis of our sort of current economic reality or environmental reality. But the sort of what they're suggesting seems slightly more spurious. What they called a paradigm shift from the general and unlimited pursuit of economic growth to a concept of right-sizing the global and national economies. But what exactly does this entail? They suggest that the attainment of global economic equilibrium will be facilitated or can be achieved by wealthy nations entering into a process of degrowth, whereas in countries where severe poverty remains right-sizing implies increasing consumption by those in poverty as quickly as possible in a sustainable way to a level adequate for a decent life, following locally determined poverty reduction paths rather than externally imposed development policies. So what seems to be suggested, and it seems to rely on a sort of trans-global sort of intergovernmental cooperation and almost a complete re-evaluation of the capitalist ethos, combined with a reliance on the existence of what is coined sustainable development. And they're sort of suggesting that if we do this, then a sort of social and a sort of global leveling will occur. And once this has been achieved, a sounder interaction with the environment will be engendered through the sort of promotion of more free time, a sense of community, individual and collective health and creativity. And that, in essence, is their proposal.
I found that really interesting because the second point where they sort of seem to identify the problem I've got, I feel like more worried about resource depletion as an immediately dangerous thing for our society. And they were talking about the fact that we are just increasing our use of natural resources, which literally are going to run out. They're just going to stop. And that's something that we've got to contend with. Now, climate change is a big enemy in the future somewhere there, which we can really imagine how it can affect us, because it seems like something you can resolve. I think what's really dangerous is resource depletion, because we can't imagine a life where we don't have oil. We can't imagine living, because literally 6 billion people on the planet can't live without that free resource of huge amounts of energy just stuck under the ground. You can't have a sustainable society which is run on fossil fuels, because it would take 25 million years to get that energy from the sun under the ground again. Sort of on a sideline, I feel like part of the reason for the current recession, and part of the reason for that is that people who are pulling the strings are starting to realize that we have resource depletion. And we have a period where maybe they can grab the last little bits, and maybe they can pull their strings and work out how they're going to keep hold of their military, they're going to keep hold of their resources, so that in the end game they can last out longer than everyone else. So I mean, I'm not really providing any answers, just a gloomy picture basically. But I mean, I think that's what we're trying to contend with. And that's why it's so difficult, because it's just so unimaginable how we can't go back to horse and carts, because we haven't got the space, because we now rely in this country on growing food in other countries with lots of agrochemicals, with lots of transportation. We don't have the space to grow that much energy-giving food that we live on and we do all our active stuff on. It just won't happen.
Really quick question.
Yes.
relating to what you were just saying, I just want to know who they is and who we is, because you're talking about sort of them holding on to power and like our resource depletion and like climate change being in the future, but then there's the whole thing about the third world are and different parts of the world are experiencing climate change right now, and they're the ones that don't consume as much, and then you're talking about the government as if they're some hierarchical they and we're just little people down here, whereas you're worrying about running out of resources, whereas some people don't have those resources and they're worried about climate change right now. And I'm worried about all these they we binaries, which is the question that was brought up over here, who's them and who's we.
I want to be talking about the people in this room maybe being able to do some action which makes us feel like we can help this whole big situation.
Also, when you talk about them as in the government, I mean, I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here because I'm very much an anarchist and that's the standpoint that I'm coming from. But in another point of view, I think it's difficult when you start to binarise that as in we in this room, as in leftists, activists and them who have the power, when a lot of them are probably people just stuck within a structure who don't think like I'm in this position of governmental power and I'm going to abuse it because I want my military, and you're talking about sort of us and them, but then to this sort of other third world contingent, possibly we're the them, you know what I mean? And
hey, just going back to what Will was saying there, market-driven solutions for climate change. I think it's interesting to think about all this free market ideology that we find, and that ultimately you need the state as a collective capitalist to bail out the market every time the shit hits the fan, like it's doing right now. Last Tuesday, the Bank of England spent more money bailing out these mortgage companies than they spend on housing benefit in a year. So what I'm trying to say is that we need to focus on who our enemy is and how we can fight them.
I was listening to what Will was saying, and I know that most people's reaction to it would have been hot, like just a sickening feeling at the kind of language that they use when they talk about these issues. Something weird about the way my mind works, I think a lot of it sounds really, really interesting, but I know that I can't. So I think, yeah, they're right. Because you know when you said the bit you didn't understand, I was there going, oh, I understand it. That sounds really, really good. But like, the thing is, I don't operate in that world very much, and I operate in a world that uses those kind of language, that kind of language very much. So it's not really relevant to my life because it's not really relevant to my actions. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to explain myself here. But what I'm trying to say is, why do the questions that we're talking about whether we should interact with the state or not cause like such a huge amount of conflict? And I was just trying to think that maybe we should think really clearly about climate change is an issue that a lot of people are addressing at the moment. And I think if we go back in the history of the concept of climate change, that we can go back to a time when it wasn't being addressed by very many people at all, and it was being addressed by a lot of people who could define their position within like political reality quite similarly, basically the excluded from the central, you know, because it wasn't being discussed by the central powers or anything like that, but now it is being discussed by the central powers as well. And I find it very rare if a group of people like similar to us or whatever, or any group of people, sit down and between themselves decide what they're going to do about climate change, that they would suggest state solutions, because they can't make state solutions. Because I was trying to think, like, how do we achieve state facilitated change? And we can do it mainly just like in the legitimised ways of free parliament, and that would be either standing in election as a climate change related candidate or lobbying existing MPs. Or trying to influence like a public debate through stunts like we do a bit, or I don't know, there really isn't, or like Greenpeace basically. So those are the only really ways that you engage through like anything related to the state, and like most people those things are like pretty excluded, but they can make changes like in their own lives or take direct action. For example, so like when a group sits down and rationally thinks about it, I think often they end up without like state solutions and stuff.
The thing is, when NGOs sit down, and like they're predominantly office workers, and like I used to be an office worker, and it's not like like you don't look around the office and go, oh, I suppose I could. I always think it's quite funny, like anyone who lives more like outdoorsy or with tools or anything like that looks around them and sees the change that they can make using like tools and stuff like that. I could go and get an allotment, I could set up a farm, I could squat a huge vast swathe of land and turn it into an environmental project, or I could dig up a motorway to look at their space and think that. If you're in an office, you look around you, you see staplers and pens, you think, oh, I could write a report and try and influence an MP, because that's like the only reality. So I think when we ask ourselves what question, you know, a lot of us ask what can we do, we come up with like lots of ideas that are quite like not very parliamentary. But like when an NGO sits down and thinks, so NGOs will always produce these reports that like look like this, because that's what they're always going to do. So and I was like, the thing that came into my head is that we don't really need to win every debate like with these people. So we only need to change the reality. So I think we're maybe the solution for, and here when I'm using we, I mean like the group of people that I belong to that does, yeah, that wants to do something about it but not necessarily parliamentary.
We need to maybe develop a bit of a thick skin, and because they're always going to be generating these reports, and if you want to stop them, the only way to stop them is like by dismantling them as NGOs, and I don't think we've got time to do that, so I think we should ignore them really. but as a way of dealing with it, because the reason I'm saying that is because I think they will always suggest like more parliamentary stuff, and to be honest,
sorry,
it might not be a bad thing if they're doing
just
it.
Just because is that all right? You just finish up and then I think.
Do stop me if I go on too long. I want to come back to what Will was saying about the whole the green capitalist thing, and I think it's quite. I don't know if anyone's ever tried looking on the internet for carbon credits and all this stuff, and there's shitloads of that stuff out there. There's huge amounts of carbon trading and the Stern report, and making capitalism sustainable has become a fucking industry, and there's a huge amount of money in it. And the reason for that is that actually capitalists, when it comes down to it, they are humans, so they've got kids, and basically if the boarding school in Switzerland gets flooded, they're going to be pissed, you know, is what it comes down to. The problem is that there comes a point beyond which the kind of necessary changes are going to take away their positions of power and influence and money. But they're still interested in trying to save capitalism as long as it doesn't go too far. I think one of the things that's quite important about that is it kind of blurs, you know, there's a temptation to assume that capitalists don't care about it, because they clearly do up to a point, which I think is quite interesting, because we've created, when we started this, as a kind of dichotomy between reform and, I guess, revolution as the two kind of options we've got there. But I think that sometimes people don't always think that through. So you could have a really, really radical approach to what is actually, you know, but in, done in a kind of, so you could decide the way to solve our problems is that you're going to lobby E.ON so they don't build a power station, but you could decide the way you're going to do that is by bombing their offices. And it's still fundamentally reformist, but it's a crazy way of doing it. And I think one of the things that's gone on in the climate change movement is there's been a tendency to focus on being the right, so we've had very, very militant lobbying a lot of the time, which is still reformist, but it's done by people who would certainly describe themselves as revolutionaries. So I think we need to be careful about assuming that all these things split into easy dichotomies, because there's some quite confusing blurring going on with people, you know, between all those issues.
Yeah, just going back to what you were saying about capitalism and the rich also, you know, want to sort out capitalism, or to sort out climate change rather. The fact of the matter is that rich people can buy their way out of trouble when the shit hits the fan. When stuff starts flooding, they can move to other areas. Poor people quite simply can't. And the other thing is, it's dangerous, I think, to humanize capitalism too much. It is a system. It's a social relation more than, you know, it is definitely a group of people who are benefiting off it disproportionately. But more than that, it's a social relation. And the only language it understands is profit.
I went to an interesting series of conferences in London this year, which were kind of about the business community and their responses to climate change. And so I was kind of like hiding at the back, trying to like not reveal my true identity. And I mean, these guys are looking 10 or 20 years ahead, and they're looking at how they're going to secure their profits as a company. I mean, given the events of the last week, it's kind of crazy to say that they're always good at securing their long-term interests, but they really are trying to do this, I think. And so I don't think we should underestimate capitalist solutions, because I think we're beginning to see them now, and some of them will work. But again, work for whom exactly? When you see things like the Stern Report, quite influential, I guess, in that you begin to see the kind of thinking where, you know, a flooded office in London is worth a lot more than a few thousand people in sub-Saharan Africa starving to death. And I think this is the kind of logic which we're going to see pursued in the coming years, because, like you say, it's a system. Profit is the only language that talks, really. So I think this is the kind of thing we've got to be aware of, and this is what the state's pushing. And I think they're ultimately wedded to the interests of capitalism as it stands. And lobbying is kind of asking nicely for them to change. They've got to be forced.
So I think that something that keeps recurring is something that Eva brought up in the very introduction, is, and that was just reiterated over here, is that who's the we and who's...
I just kind of wonder where that kind of guilty thinking gets us, because you can choose who...
Sorry, it's not guilt, it's just it's ambiguity and searching for clarification further than anything else. And I think what I'd like is when people do say we and them, for them to identify the we and the them that they're talking about, because that's not clear to me at all.
I think it's a really significant and relevant point. I think a lot of the time we try and understand really... Oh, people in general, human beings, anyone, tries to understand big issues in terms of simple narratives, and then we try and thread those simple narratives together. The thing is that often the we's that are defined within those separate narratives do not correlate. But yeah, so when actually people will reel off a load of their own personal kind of understandings of different issues, and you try and follow the groups that they've said between them, and that it doesn't make any sense. I think that's, yeah, sorry, I'm only reiterating what you said to illustrate that at least somebody other than...
What I was trying to say is that, yeah, there is obviously huge disparities between how these issues affect different groups of people, but ultimately I identify as a worker, as someone who feels vastly oppressed by capitalism and the state and wants to overthrow it for everyone. I think it's important, you know, to these questions of we and who we are very important. I think the way that we answer them is through practice, through building a we, through, you know, through building a collective revolutionary subject.
Yeah, I sort of agree.
Related to the we question, I often find the world's biggest metaphor to be quite useful with this, the Titanic. It's kind of, we're all on a sinking ship, but ultimately, if you don't have a first class ticket, then you're probably in a lot more trouble. You're going to be on a lifeboat with guns guarding you. I think, although we don't have much control over the situation we're in, we're ultimately on a lifeboat with people with guns guarding us and protecting us. And that's a lot different from the people in second class.
I just wanted to add, like, the contradiction to that as well, which goes back to what Gareth was saying about capitalism being a set of social relations which is out of control, and it's perfectly capable of capitalism to destroy everything, including the people that appear to be benefiting from it. So like, on the one hand, like, yeah, I think we do need to think more before we like reel off like our narratives, because I think like some of them are quite confusing, and I think it is really important to so when Gareth was saying it's a social relation, and there may not be actually anyone that's benefiting from it, because the corporation can become like the only real agent, as all of the people, including its shareholders and its the people that run it, can submit their own interests in favour of its interests and stuff. So it can be a runaway system from which no one benefits. So that's why we're in a confusing situation.
Since we're going down this metaphor, I was just wondering about, obviously there's rich people that have chartered lifeboats to come along and follow the Titanic along this journey, and then there's some of us as well that are perhaps hammering bits of nails and woods together and building our own little life rafts and planning it on that kind of action, and, you know, getting together and saying, okay, we can all keep each other afloat, you know, when this goes down. Or
I like that. That's a nice positive way to go I think now's a good time to go into a break. We were thinking like a 20 minute break, have a drink at the bar, have a cigarette, then come back and to listen to Andy's put together a 15 minute presentation for us, which I listened to at Climate Camp and I found really, really interesting, which I guess is one of the reasons why we chose to put on this, one of the things that inspired us to put on this series of debates in the first place. And I guess something seems to have come up, and maybe something, if it's possible, I'd quite like us to address is, can/will state-led solutions address the current problems of global injustice? Like, if the state is proposing solutions to climate change, is there a chance that they're going to address these problems?
Thank you.